everybody. I'm Scott, and welcome to the Shelfware Podcast. This week, we have Jenny Colvin from the Reading Envy Podcast with us. Hi, Jenny.
Hello. Thanks for having
me. Thank you so much for being here. Absolutely thrilled. So tell me a little bit about the Reading Envy Podcast. It's been going on for a long time.
It has, and I think by the time this episode posts, we'll have hit 200 episodes.
Fantastic.
So that's pretty exciting.
That is cool.
I most of the time just talk to all kinds of readers about what they're reading, like books that they've read like and liked recently. So not like the best books of all time, but also not necessarily all new release books, just kind of more the way people read. It's really fun.
It is fun.
Met a lot of very interesting readers and heard a lot of books I wouldn't have heard of otherwise.
Yeah, that's for sure. And me too. You know, I've been on your podcast and I've listened to it. I love the Reading Envy Pub so very much. It's a place that I love to go. But yeah, I've got a lot of reading recommendations from your podcast. And so thank you very much.
Thank you. It's really fun to see when people say, I've heard about this book on that podcast and now I'm reading it. And I love that.
Oh, me too. That's great. So you picked a book, you know, The Only Good Indians by Stephen Graham Jones. Perfect October book.
Yeah, because we were talking about possibly doing another book, and I thought, well, is this going to happen in October? Because I like to read scary stuff for October. And so we landed on this one because I needed to read it anyway. I just want to say, I don't actually read a lot of horror, and so every time I do, even if I enjoy it, I feel kind of weird about it. Because this is really, definitely in the horror genre.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Do you read Stephen King at all?
I've actually read more by his son than by him.
Interesting. Yeah, the reason that I asked that is because, you know, that's definitely horror, too.
Sure.
And this guy to me reminded me of Stephen King in how he's so down to earth. And his characters are, you know, they're working, they have jobs, they're, you know, one of them was working for the Postal Service, and there was a little bit about, you know, how annoyed he was with that. But just how Stephen Graham Jones conveys that reminded me of how Stephen King conveys that. And there's an instant connection to the characters when that happens. I liked them pretty quickly, or I connected with them is probably the better way to say it.
Yeah, and I think the only other horror that I've read that I could really say I like is Nathan Ballingrud, and for me that's always how I connect with his stories too. It's the humanity of the characters, you know, he really writes that so well. And I really liked the characters in this book so much that I think it made the horror parts worse.
You're right. It did. I think you have an affinity for this author, right? Stephen Graham Jones. How did you first run across him?
I went to a reading at Malaprops in Asheville of Thomas Olde Huvelt, who's a Dutch horror author. I've read his one novel that's been translated into English, which is called Hex. And I kind of cornered him and asked him to give me a really quick interview.
Oh, cool.
And so he told me what he was reading at that time. And one of the people he mentioned is Stephen Graham Jones and the book Mongrels. And so I thought that was cool. And then I had recorded an episode with Brian Alexander right around that time specifically about horror, because he reads a lot more of it than I do. And so I had inserted that little interview into the podcast episode. So that was in 2016. And then I came across this quiz of like, which indie press should you be obsessed with? I think it was a Book Riot quiz, and it sent me to Curbside Splendor. And so I'm looking through the Curbside Splendor books, and there's that author again. And it was a collection of short stories. So of course I got that from the library. And so I think that was in 2017 that I read that, and it was called After the People Lights Have Gone Off, which was so good. And the book is really beautifully published. There's all these like full page, you know, black artwork pieces I can't really describe. And then I ended up following it up reading Mongrels the next year, which is like, it's funny. It's not as horrific. It's like a werewolf coming of age story. It's pretty cool. Cute.
And it's good, huh?
Yeah, it's really good.
Oh, that's neat. Yeah, I looked that up just as I was poking through. He seems to be pretty prolific.
Yeah, I think he's written like 15 books, so there's a lot more that I haven't read than I have, but they all look like they're a little bit different, which is good.
Yeah, that is cool. That is cool. On this one, you know, The Only Good Indians, I think it's important to mention, or it actually adds a dimension to it, that he is Native American. And yes. The book is about Native Americans, and that adds a depth to it, I think.
Absolutely. It's like specifically Blackfeet.
Mm-hmm.
And so he is also Blackfeet.
Cool. Yeah. He grew up in Texas from just an interview that I heard of him. He said he grew up in West Texas, and he's in Colorado at a university. So he's got a PhD, and I'm not sure what. I didn't catch what it was in. But it sounds like literature, because I heard him on a podcast talking about his dissertation, which was a novel that he wrote.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. Imagine writing a novel and then having to defend a novel in a dissertation committee. That seems pretty rough.
Well, yeah, you'd have to really, I don't know, those people would really have to know what they were doing as far as like understanding your work.
Yep.
Which usually the genre people, they're not so open to that. So,
yeah. So let me read, if I could, the, I guess the cover stuff. I don't have a physical copy, so I'm on the Simon & Schuster website. And I'm just going to read in an attempt of synopsis what this copy says. The Only Good Indians is a tale of revenge, cultural identity, and the cost of breaking from tradition. In this latest novel from the Jordan Peele of horror literature, Stephen Graham Jones. Seamlessly, I had the same reaction. It's a little bit of an eye roller for me there. Seamlessly blending classic horror and a dramatic narrative with sharp social commentary, The Only Good Indians follows four American Indian men after a disturbing event from their youth puts them in a desperate struggle for their lives. Tracked by an entity bent on revenge, these childhood friends are helpless as the culture and traditions they left behind catch up to them in a violent, vengeful way. What do you think of that?
Other than the reference to Jordan Peele, which is not necessary, I don't think.
Yeah,
it's good. I mean, was it in their childhood? I didn't really think of it as childhood. I kind of pictured them as being like maybe in their 20s when they did what they did.
Yeah, I was thinking teens. But you're right. In this area, they were young men.
Yeah.
One of the things that I was looking at when you first mentioned this book was some of the reviews, and one of them compared it to It and Ghost Story. So It by Stephen King, Ghost Story by Peter Straub, which are both books about something that happened in the past catching up to them in the future, right? Or the present, or whatever, however you want to put it.
Yeah, I've seen like people when interviewing him, they like compare it to slasher novels or slasher films, which I've never seen, and revenge films or revenge storylines. So I thought that was interesting. All of these men come from this tradition where, you know, they have certain things that are like old beliefs, or maybe they haven't felt them as being relevant, but they're still so aware of them that, you know, like the thing that they did that was 10 years ago was kind of in defiance of maybe what the elders would want, right? So that stuff is always in their minds. Yeah. And so I think that that underlying belief or structure is something that comes back through all of the stories inside the book of what happens to them and why there's a revenge story at all anyway, because I think if a just like old white guy had gone and hunted down an elk, you know, I just don't think that that story wouldn't work.
Right.
Because they wouldn't have an understanding of it the way these four men have. And so that just adds so much to the story.
Yeah, I think. You're absolutely right. Because of this underlying thing that there's this tradition that they are striking against with full knowledge, right, is that adds the whole depth to it, because now it's becomes a metaphor for the times too, where there's so much, there always has been, you know, among young people, pushing against a tradition is a very normal, natural thing that's happened throughout history. It's almost like, once something is recognized as tradition, it's in trouble, young people are always doing that. But, in this case, it's a spiritual beliefs are part of those traditions.
Yeah, I guess I should stop there, but there's so much inside that. That's really fascinating to me.
Absolutely. And that's really what pushes us beyond just a typical horror novel.
There's a character in here that plays basketball, and she's like the best basketball player they've seen in, forever. Mm-hmm. And so her storyline plays into that too in a really fun way.
Yeah, and this part of that idea is that she's getting out, right?
It's her only ticket out.
Exactly. And that's why it's so incredible. They're like, oh, she's going to get to go to a university and play there and get an education and get out of here,
Right. And I think that becomes more important because of the four men, two of them have left the reservation, but two of them still live there and have never left from what I understand. And so one of those two men is that woman's father. So
yeah,
I think he's very proud of this idea that she'll get to leave, even though he's not actually allowed to be around her.
Right.
He can be proud from afar.
Absolutely. For sure. So yeah. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we cross that barrier into spoiler territory and talk in depth?
I will just say that this is a very actual horror novel with a lot of gore and content warnings for everything.
Right. Very good. Okay. All right. So now let's start talking about this book.
Okay. So it starts with Ricky, and Ricky is never around the other guys in the story because he dies in the first chapter. But how he dies is he's at a bar. Well, he's moved to North Dakota, to work there. And he's valued because of his background. They're like, you guys never get cold, which is ridiculous.
I actually highlighted that. Yeah. And in that way, that's kind of the Stephen King-ish stuff. Sorry to interrupt, but those details are what is just so interesting and gives me empathy for that character immediately. His feelings about that are important.
Right.
And also, Stephen Graham Jones is showing us how Indians get treated by non-Indians, right? Or Native Americans,
and
we'll
use the word Indian, I should say, because like the characters in the novel use it. And so we're going to give ourselves permission, even though that's technically, we know it's not the politically correct term.
Yeah, but. And I when I listened to the interview with Stephen Graham Jones, that was brought up as well. I guess there was a little thing on Twitter where somebody said, why did you use this even in the title? And he said that's how he views himself. He's around 50 years old, I believe. Mm-hmm. But that's how he's always viewed himself. He says he knows that the word has a lot of baggage with it, but that's what he's always used his whole life. So that's how he views himself. So that's why he used it.
I believe in using the words people want to have used. So that works. Yep. And I think in some like younger people, they'll use the NDN, like the word, the letters.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what you call it. It's not really an acronym, but that kind of is fun too. But he really just uses the word. So.
Okay. Yep.
And Ricky's a good example of someone who's used very heavy labor to escape. And so he's relocated to North Dakota. He's actually on his way to Minnesota for this new life that he's really excited about. And he's drunk in a bar and the line for the bathroom is too long. And so he decides to go outside to take care of everything. And that's when he sees the elk. And there's this giant elk in the parking lot where all these trucks are. And it took me forever to figure out what a something 20 was or something. Like, I don't know what these things are. It was a car, I think.
Yeah.
And so the elk is damaging the cars. And so he grabs something from a truck, like a wrench, to try to get the elk to leave. But no one else can see the elk. So all they see is the damage to the trucks and this guy standing there with a wrench. And so they basically kill him, or he dies, or
yeah.
And there's this like thread running through the whole thing where it's like they think of headlines in their heads. And so he's like, oh, I should just find the line, because it's the line of the end of the first chapter.
Yeah, I've got it here.
Okay.
It's Indian man killed in dispute outside bar.
And then doesn't it say something like that after it?
It says that's like, one way to say it is what it says.
Yeah, that's one way to say
it. One way to say it, yeah.
A lot of those headlines that they come up with, it just makes it sound like, oh, yeah, it's more of these guys. They just, you know, there's all these stories that people tell about Indians, right? Like, you know, that they can't take care of themselves, that they're drunks. That's kind of like the narrative that we're told. And, you know, it's like the first hint of like there might be a lot more to it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because his life was actually going pretty good. Like, he was... Mm-hmm. I mean, he was, you know, working, but he was working.
That's right.
And so then the story kind of jumps to Lewis, and we spend a lot more time with Lewis. Lewis kind of becomes the primary narrator. And I loved Lewis. I feel like what I've read of the author, I almost felt like he was like the author, because, you know, he has this wife and they, you know, I don't know. Some of the details were kind of the same. They live off the reservation. She is not Native American. And so he's kind of broken the rules even with that. And you find out a little bit later, they're not having kids. And so he's not even perpetuating the line, which the ancestors would be unhappy about. And like that's another place where the headline comes in, right? He originally thought the headline would be that he'd mutated the strain, and it's not that at all. It's like there is no strain. I thought that was funny.
That was funny. What did you think of the tense change? So the first chapter is written kind of in a normal third person, but then when it starts talking about Lewis, it becomes present.
I definitely noticed when it shifted after that, when it was more like second person.
Yes. Yeah. So for me, it took a minute for me to get into it. And by a minute, it was probably about 10. I was reading a Kindle version, so it's about 10% of the way in. I finally got in, because I haven't read many things with this tense. So the very first sentence, this is an example. The very first sentence of the Lewis section says, Lewis is standing in the vaulted living room of his and Peta's new rent house, staring straight up at the spotlight over the mantel, daring it to flicker on now that he's looking at it. So that Lewis is. That's how the whole thing's written. You know, so it's like Lewis says this. Let's see, I'm trying to find other examples. But
it's not necessarily from his point of view, but you're still at the same time limited to what he's experiencing, which is a weird combination.
Yeah, exactly. And so it took me a minute to get fully into the story. But once I was in, the whole thing flowed like just nonstop. I mean, I found it a very quick read. A very immersive read. 100%. In fact, you know, there would be things that we'll get to those things, but so into it that I was having really pronounced reactions to what was happening.
I mean, you finished this book before I did.
that's impossible. Had you started it when I even finished it is the question.
Sometimes with horror novels, I have to put them aside. Like, they have to be put in the who is it that we know that puts books in the freezer? I can't remember, but
books in the freezer. I hadn't heard that one. That's awesome.
Gosh, some podcast that I listened to for a while, if someone was upset about a book, they'd put it in the freezer.
Wow. I haven't heard of that.
Okay.
Oh, that's awesome.
And there were just some moments where I'm like, holy crap.
Yeah.
And I'd like put the book down and I'd be like, I just sit there for a while. Like, holy crap.
Yeah.
So Lewis and his wife's name is Peta. I like their relationship a lot. And for a while, to me, I thought this was going to be a relationship novel, because like, that's what I like. I like relationship novels. Yeah, shock the heck out of me.
Yeah, and it was kind of, you know. So what was her name? Shaney. Shaney,
I think. So there's this whole storyline where he works at the post office. He's mm-hmm. training a new coworker. I didn't realize she was new until I went back to the beginning. Mm-hmm. And she does have some ancestry. She's Crow.
Right.
Is that a tribe? Mm-hmm. And so they have this bond that he's trying to ignore, but it's definitely there. And he's definitely attracted to her. And she comes to borrow some books from him when his wife is gone. And she comes home to find them together, just talking. But it's obviously a very intimate conversation because he's telling her a story he never told his wife.
Mm. And something that his wife knew about, too. Something that is so much a part of his life in guilt and things that she knew that there's this problem that he has. But he would never talk about it. So it's even worse than you said. It's like, this is something that she has been trying to get him to talk about probably since they met, and he wouldn't. And then he unloads to this other Native American woman.
Right. So it's like the ultimate betrayal. I mean, that's almost more intimate than other types of intimacy would be.
Yeah, for sure.
And so, But there's a thing that's triggered it, and that light that you mentioned, he's trying to fix this light for his wife, you know, is being the the charming house husband or whatever. And so he gets up on the ladder and he sees the body of the elk like laying on the floor. And so, you know, he starts to fall and she actually rescues him, not the elk, his wife. She sees him falling and she goes and catches him so he doesn't hit his head on the bricks. Which was pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he just can't get out of his head. Like, he's starting to hear noises. He's starting to sense the presence. And I guess we never really explained. Like, they do kill a bunch of elk. And they do it in this protected area that is supposed to be only for the elders. So, whoa, you know, big problem.
Right.
But the part of the story that the others don't know is that he killed a female elk and took like an embryo calf out of her body.
Yeah.
And so, of course, it died. So everything died.
Yeah.
But that's the elk, or it's not the baby that's haunting him, right? It's the mother.
Yeah.
Maybe, I'm not sure.
Yeah. And they came upon a herd. And it was like, this is exactly what we want, right? A whole herd of elk is right in front of them while they're out hunting illegally in the spot where they shouldn't even be. And this elk, and their reaction was not to take an elk like they were hoping to. Their reaction was to open fire and kill as many of them as they possibly could. And then this one female elk, like you said, was just a horrifying thing. She was still alive when he was starting to, field dress her, I think is what you say. Yeah. And, there was an embryo, so he had to shoot it again. And it was horrible. There was just something about this elk, the eyes, everything about it. There was something going on. You could feel that there was something going on, and he was apologizing. And this is Lewis, right? The other three didn't seem to care or really notice a heck of a lot of what was going on, but Lewis was having this moment with this elk and promised to use every bit of her, thanking her for her life and things. You hear about that kind of stuff among hunters and stuff that do that. It's like using every bit of it is a respect to the elk. And he's hoping that will put him right, because he knows that he's not right. He knows that whatever's happening here, he's on the wrong side of it. And then that embryo that you're talking about, that was a moment, you know, where there's this live embryo. It's so freshly, the mother had so freshly died that it was still alive. And then he buried it in the snow. Yeah. The other guys were like, okay, let's just take hindquarters, everybody, because that's all we have room for in this truck. It's only a half ton, and these things weigh 2,000 pounds a piece. So, I mean, they were well over the line of respecting everything. All the tradition that they had been taught at that moment was being tossed.
And I think even from a legal standpoint, you don't
they were,
shoot that many animals.
Right, like, they were well past legality. Yeah.
And so somehow, you don't really find this out until later, but somehow they get found out. Mm-hmm. And like, because he talks about wrapping up all the meat and delivering it to the elders who would have eaten it otherwise. And they were banned from hunting for 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the only thing I could figure out. Like, I was a little bit confused as to why this was happening specifically now. Did you ever figure that out?
No, other than it was like 20 years later, 210s or something like that. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I guess that's, and is there anything else in the background that matters? I mean, there's some kind of joke, like he wrapped the elk in raccoon paper because he didn't have an elk stamp or something.
Like yeah.
But he thought maybe someone had disrespected some of the meat, like thrown it out or something. Mm. I don't know. And yeah, that had caused all this to happen. But I was kind of like, well, I mean, if anything was disrespecting it, it was the initial,
yeah,
the right. initial act, but
right. Right.
But you don't get the impression that in the previous years that he's had this kind of haunted existence or anything. He's just been having a normal life. I mean, he did move off the reservation and that seemed to kind of maybe cut ties a little bit with some of the guilt feelings. But other than that, you don't get the impression that this has been a problem until now.
Right. Yeah. And it's kind of a steady going insane kind of a situation in for him right now. Almost like a, it reminded me a little bit of Edgar Allan Poe. What's the story with the heart? Oh, the Telltale Heart, where, yeah, you know, he's just feeling this guilt that's overwhelming and he's just going crazy. But there, he starts to see things, like you said, when he's up there in the light with the fan going, and he looks through the fan and there's an elk on the floor and he's like, what, you know? So, you wonder, at least I did as the reader, did he really see that? Is he, you know, throughout that whole section, I was like, is what he's seeing real? Is he just going crazy?
Yeah. I never was sure.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure now that I've read the rest of it, that it was real. That's yeah, my impression. But at the time, all the way to the end of the section, well, I guess I knew it was real because he was holding a calf, an elk calf, when he died in that right. news story at the end. Yeah. So,
but in between there, like first he decides that his wife is maybe this calf reborn.
Oh man. Yeah.
And so, first his dog yeah, was trying to escape the yard. They live really near a train or something, but something's been bothering the dog so much that it wants to escape.
Yeah.
And so it gets injured in the course of that. And he's been rehabilitating him in the garage and then he gets trampled basically. Mm-hmm. There's not a good explanation for that. He's worried he did it or that someone else did it. Obviously it was the elk that did it.
Yep.
But it takes a while to figure that out. And so the dog dies. And then not long after that, which is where I kind of first had to go back and reread a little bit. He also basically kills his wife.
Oh man.
In a very disgusting way.
Oh my God. Okay. So he kills, Shaney first. Right. So she's over at the house and he's going through this whole thing where he's like, one of these two is this elk, right? And that's the crazy that he's going through. There's something going on.
One of these Shaney's two. Shaney's new at work. She right. just showed up. And
he's logically, like you said, logically trying to figure out which one of these killed the dog, and whoever killed the dog is the elk. And so he invites Shaney over to pick something up that he needs delivered to some, you know, he just a ruse to get her. And there is this, sexual tension between them too. Shaney's very beautiful, it says, and, she clearly likes him. But Lewis keeps telling himself my wife, I keep reminding Shaney that I have a wife, you know, but yet he keeps having her around. So there is this thing going on. But his idea is, okay, what I need to do is I need to see Shani through that same fan. You know, this is his logic. I need to be on top of this ladder. I need to be looking through the fan, and I need Shani to walk in there, and then I'll know if she is the Elk Woman. You know, and
right, 'cause there's something about how the fan detracts your eyes and makes you see things that are real, or
right. Yeah. And that's his logic, because he's seen the elk and he's seen the Elk Woman through the fan. So anyway, that scene just blew me away. So he gets her. The first thing she does when she walks in the room is turn off the fan. Yeah. And he's like, aha, because she turned off the fan, she knows what I'm doing. And therefore, you know, I mean, all this logic is going on in his head. And then he's like inviting her, you know, I need to show you this. I need to show you this. And then he takes her out to the garage and showing her this motorcycle, and he's set it up. And by the time that was happening, I said, no way. I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it when that scene happened.
Yeah. 'Cause see, I still thought I'm like back on relationship novel, right? Uh-huh, yeah. I still thought like, they're going to have a fling or something. Yeah. He's acting weird because he doesn't know how to start it.
Exactly. Exactly.
Whew.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't spend too much energy trying to actually picture what was described, because I don't quite understand. Need to. Right. But I basically think somehow he made the part of the motorcycle scalp her somehow.
Yeah. Right. He basically lined it up so that her hair would get caught in the thing when he turned it on. And he was very meticulous in how he was doing that. And
and I feel like the author was sitting back there going, it's like an Indian thing. Get it?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Holy smokes. Ugh. Couldn't believe it. Yeah. And then, gosh, there's blood everywhere and stuff. And yeah, it's just intense. And then now PETA comes home. While he's dealing with that, PETA comes home, you know, so he was in the garage and he closed the garage door, but then PETA comes home and then,
he didn't realize his hands were covered in blood.
He had no idea. Isn't that amazing? Yeah. Had no idea. So, yeah. And then, PETA dies exactly how she saved him from dying.
Yeah.
You know, so
awful.
Just awful.
Yeah, that whole thing is pretty brutal. And you kind of get this impression that he just like leaves.
Yeah, and it's an interesting choice that the author then he moves into, you know, it's like, you know, he's leaving and but then he tells us what happened to Lewis through a newspaper.
Yeah, I guess we forgot to talk about a part in that he figured out that his wife was pregnant.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And so he removes the embryo, but it's not human. It has hooves.
Yeah, and it's intense. My gosh, right.
Yeah. Okay, so explain that. So we know, like first the article, like what you said in the newspaper says, you know, this guy is wanted for the brutal murder of two women,
mm-hmm.
and there's a child missing. And then later on, he's discovered with this elk baby.
Exactly. Right.
And no one knows where the child is.
And that's why I knew that's when I said, okay, so it's real.
Yeah.
You know, it's not him losing his mind. This is actually happening to him.
So, but like, if you follow the logic all the way through, does that mean that his wife was not really his wife?
I guess it's possible, but it's not clear at all. But the thing is, the elk woman is still there. So was like the wife possessed by the, I don't know. It's like, yeah, there's so many explanations. Like she knows she wasn't really pregnant, or she was pregnant because the elk woman put an elk there. I don't know.
It's unsettling regardless.
It's very, very unsettling.
And so then you kind of find slowly, like that story just kind of ends. Like he has a confrontation, gets killed by the police, basically.
Yeah.
Who shoot him across the field or whatever. Because he won't come close to where they are. Because he tries to retreat by going back to the reservation.
Yeah.
But you kind of get the impression that he didn't get there all the way, or it's almost like it happens on the periphery of the story. So I kind of almost lost track of where he went. I don't know.
Yeah. And a thing that kind of ties this in, well, I mean, we're all tied together because of the people that were there at that elk event when they were younger. But the news story says, at some point in the drive back to town, according to this survivor, someone stood from the bed of the truck while it was moving. It was a girl of 12 or 14, Indian. Presumably, she had climbed into the truck earlier when it was going west. But that is this elk woman.
Right.
Who is going through all these phases. It's like she's morphing into all these different people.
But there's a teenage one that shows up multiple occasions. Uh-huh. So I almost thought maybe that was the cult. And then, like, I thought maybe there were two.
Mm.
I actually don't know which way to read it.
Yeah, I don't either.
So then we shift to the characters of Gabe and Cass.
Yes. Yeah.
And I guess we get to Cass first, right? Because he's the one that has Cheeto as a brother. Is right. that right?
Yes.
So his brother had committed suicide or died by suicide. So he was wanting to leave. Gabe is the one who has the daughter. And they know that they're the remaining two of this four. Like, they remember. It's not a surprise. And so then, basically, after all these things that happen, they decide that they're going to have a sweat. You know, like the traditional kind of purging of all the things.
Right.
Except sweat for, instead of using like someone's actual sweat lodge, they're going to create one with like sleeping bags that the dogs have been sleeping in.
Yeah, these heavy, heavy sleeping bags. Yep.
And one of their fathers is the cop, Victor. Is that Gabe's or Cass's father?
So it's actually neither. So Victor has a son named Nathan that he brings to there as well. It's almost like to do the sweat lodge, we need another person who's putting the rocks in there and stuff. So they, I'm not sure if they're related. In my head, they weren't. But yeah, Victor and Nathan. And Nathan is a teenager who the father really wants him to go through this sweat lodge experience because of what's going on in his life. And he's also non-traditional, meaning he's rebelling against the tradition. And he's like, well, we need to go through this sweat lodge experience so that you understand some things.
Right.
So he actually pays, was it Cass or Gabe? I can't remember which one he actually paid, but it was like, okay, you guys are doing the sweat lodge and I want to put my son in there too, is what my impression was. And here I'll pay you for it. Right. So, and then I will be the rock guy, the guy who's heating the rocks, and I'll put that in there. So in the sweat lodge, you have Cass and Gabe who were there at the original elk event. And then this teenager who's the son of the guy that's outside feeding the rocks into the sweat lodge.
And you get the impression that the four guys had that experience when they were his age too.
Yeah, right.
Like it may have not have stuck.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But it's just definitely something that, you know, they remember and was significant to them.
Yeah.
And so I think in their own way, they're actually trying to pass this tradition on, but they've never really received the training in how to do that.
Yeah, so it's a really interesting dynamic. So you've got these guys that rejected the tradition a long time ago and have been loosely affiliated with it. And then you have this brand new teenager and they're trying to pass their tradition on to the, you know, so it's like suddenly the tradition is important, you know? So it's just an interesting dynamic that I think generations of people go through all the time where, you know, you go through this middle age where you're fighting the tradition and then you may accept it later in life and you, as you become the older person, and then you're like, that stuff is important. You know, we're losing our language or, you know, we're losing our religion and we're trying to pass this on. But yet there could be regret because you've spent your whole life not really engaging in it. And now you kind of want it. But yet they're, like you said, awkwardly trying to pass this to this teenager. I thought those scenes were really cool. Yeah. They were really affecting, and you know, they're pouring, a ladle onto the rocks so that the steam comes up, and then they offer a drink to someone who has passed away, you know, and they say the name, and they just pour that onto the ground, and then the teenager participates in that. He says, you know, my grandfather, or can't remember what the first name that he said, but that was meaningful to the kid, right?
Yeah.
And I love that.
Like, yeah, kind of like their form of mourning.
Exactly. And suddenly he starts to see there's just something to this tradition that is not all, you know, crap or whatever. It's not all oppression or whatever it is that he's feeling. We're never clear, you know, just a teenage rebellion against authority. But these traditions come from a long past, and it's always hard, especially in today's age. I feel like in today's age, more than other ages, traditions are hard to pass.
Yeah. It's so funny because it's not really a tangent. I started this book about indigenous plant knowledge. Uh-huh. It's like ethnobotany is what it's called.
Oh, wow. And cool.
It's this woman who comes from one of these traditions, and she's been traveling around trying to collect information before it disappears because this is always just orally passed tradition.
Yeah.
And it's just specifically about plants, but there's so many more things like that it was kind of interesting. Like, I almost wanted to know more about Victor because he seemed to know the tradition of the sweat lodge more than the others, but he wasn't going to participate, you know, inside, just outside.
Yeah, because I don't think it would have been the same for his son if his dad was there.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Right.
Unfortunately, that put him in a vulnerable position.
It did, yeah.
And so he was the first to go. Little did he know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a trailer nearby because Cass or Gabe's wife or partner or whatever, mm-hmm, girlfriend lives there.
Yeah. Joe.
And he thinks that it's her because the being has put on her laundry that was hanging up drying. Yeah. And so he dies. Mm-hmm. I don't really want to be more descriptive than that. Oh, he dies. And then after that, it's just like a bloodbath.
Oh my gosh.
The dogs, the guys, but this is happening in the dark.
But yeah, and it's cold. It's snow on the ground. You know, they're in a sweat lodge or sweaty. Nathan runs away.
Yeah.
Intense. And then it moves to the next section, which is about Denora. And I thought this was really interesting because, again, the author has showed us enough to be super afraid. And then he leaves before it's done. And then Denora comes. Denora is a teenage girl who's the daughter of Gabriel, or Gabe, who was one of the original four that were at that elk incident. And
she's the basketball player.
And she's the basketball player we were talking about, who's better than anybody's ever seen. And she is there because Gabe promised her some money. He said, come get some money after this because I'm going to, you know, I'm going to be paid to do this sweat lodge for this teenager. So she shows up, and then she gets to see the aftermath of it. So it's not unlike, you know, the end of the Lewis story. We're horrified. It can't believe what's going on. And then he ends it with that news story where we don't get to see the end of Lewis. We read about a news story about it. And then hear the same thing. We didn't get to see the end of Cass and Gabe and all them. We just see the aftermath through Denora's eyes, and that is horror. It's super effective, but man, yeah.
Do you think that that's a cop out?
I don't. I think that it's like, you know, well, what's scary? Is seeing the gore scary, or is the fact that it happened scary? So what he's, I think that happens a lot in movies too. There's this line: are you grossing people out, or are you trying to scare them? Right. It's almost two different things. And I think that it's deliberate. So I think that he showed enough to absolutely horrify us, and to have taken that further is now you're grossing people out. You're not horrifying them anymore.
Yeah. I mean, even just some of the hints of that were more than my brain could take. My brain was like, jump down the page.
No question. No question. And this one of the things that happened in that section is when he switched to second person, like you said. And yes. I don't fully get what, I mean, it really got me, meaning it really worked for me.
Well, and the you is the elk mother, right?
Right.
So who's the narrator?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay. Right when he's cranking his window down to see better, this is Gabe. So this is early. Right when he's cranking his window down to see better, you raise your face, level your eyes at him through your black hair blowing everywhere. And this is the first time you've seen him since that day. The air full of sound, your nose breathing in just blood, your calf gasping inside you, your legs gone. Don't look away. Make him be the one to break eye contact. Listen to his truck accelerate away. It doesn't matter that he saw you now either. The next time he lays eyes on you, you'll be taller, different, better. Already these stolen clothes are getting tight. Awesome. I mean, I was there. When I read that, I was fully there, right? And I was the elk mother for a second.
Yeah.
What that means, I don't know yet. But I do know that after I finished reading this, it's like it has grown inside me since. You know what I mean? It's like it's still there and it's still growing. You know, and here we are talking about it. But it's just in there and it's not finished with me yet.
Have you been turning on the lights before you go around corners?
No, I haven't. Because I am the elk woman. I'm the one that's horrifying to other people, I guess. I don't know.
You know, I love second person so much. I always have when it's used really intentionally. Mm-hmm. And I feel like in this case, what it's doing is it's pulling you closer to her power almost. Oh, man.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like you can't escape it.
Right.
Just like they can't escape it. And yeah, it's kind of like what you're describing.
Yeah. It worked so well for me. I was seeing through her eyes. I was watching him drive away. I felt what she felt, you know. It was,
yeah.
Awesome. I don't know that I've experienced anything like that before. Huh. I mean, in a book, doing it that way, I don't think I've run across it.
Yeah. It's so effective.
Yeah.
The other thing I really like about this section is the basketball game.
Yes, right. And that's in the last section there. It came from the res is the name of that section. So that's when Denora shows up and she's there to get the money from her dad, Gabe, and sees someone there who she initially thinks is Joe, who is also dead because everybody is.
Right.
There's a pretty high body count here. But the elk woman's motivation is, okay, now that I've killed these four, now I'm going to kill a kid because that's what they did to me. So now she's after Denora. And then that last section is Denora who shows up and the elk woman, I mean, this seems funny when you say it out loud, but she challenges her to a basketball game. And Denora has the biggest game of her life later on in the day. And she's like, the coach will kill me if the coach knows that I'm using up my energy in the morning.
Right.
But she starts to play anyway because she knows something's going on. And during the game is when she realizes what she's up against.
Yeah, and I think the really amazing part about it is that she's so good.
Yeah.
That they're almost evenly matched.
Right.
Which actually is a great analogy because of the death of the colt.
Yes.
And this is the child of one of them, you know, so mm-hmm. it's like even like double meaning. And like they're just plastered in sweat, and she's completely shredded her muscles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's pretty amazing.
It is amazing.
I was really upset when she died.
I didn't have that impression.
Really?
Yeah. So I'm looking at it and I'm wondering. So let's see. So Denora looks up that long hill in the winking scope in the dead eye of her new dad, because her new dad came and he was blowing away the Elkhead woman to the calf, you know, and the Elkhead has to stop. Mm-hmm. She can see her real dad dead in that burned down sweat lodge. Because nobody can kill that. So this is where the old man looks face to face.
Oh, yeah, because he made the shape, right?
Right.
Like, this is over.
Yeah, exactly. So she holds her red hand and says, no, Dad, no. Is this the first time she's called him that? And it is. By slow degrees, the rifle raises its butt. Boom.
Oh, no, you're right. Because it said, just like the girl does 4 years later when her team loses state.
Okay.
So you're right, she didn't die.
So but why is it the girl, the capital G, when did she turn into the girl? So I'm like, is that the same person? So let's see. So instead, the man shape up there, he's sliding his right hand sideways, palm down, left to right like this, the old man says. It's the Indian way of saying a thing is over. It's what he used to end every meeting with when he was trying to pull Gabe and Cass and Ricky and Lewis back to keep them alive. It's what he thought he would have told his grandson if they could have. It's over enough. If you can stop, you can stop. It can stop here if you want it to stop. And then it just says the girl now. Interesting. Nods about this.
Okay, but...
knows what the hand signal means.
There's also this description.
Yeah.
That she places her small body between the rifle and the elk that killed her dad. And she holds her right hand up to make that same motion.
Uh-huh.
And then by slow degrees, the rifle raises... He's just a silhouette, just another hunter.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. It's not clear, is it?
Yeah. But then...
you're right. Is the girl the girl?
It turns into the girl. Why isn't it Denora anymore? Or why... So she becomes part of a story or something? So this,
I don't...
Fascinating. Okay?
Yeah.
Because it's the end of the thing. Hand up again. Like the girl did that day. And all the children do as well. And then, just like the girl does 4 years later when her team loses state in double overtime, he balls that hand into an upraised fist. What the girl will be doing with that held up fist at the end of that forever game, it's honoring the Crow team that finally figured out how to shut her down, the first defense ever to do it, one of the last. That show of sportsmanship, of respect, is what gets silhouetted on thousands of posters all through high school sports. Wow.
But is the reason they lost because the way they beat her was to replace her with an elk child?
I don't know. So because it's the end of the story, the old man holds his right hand up again, just like the girl did that day. And all the children, just like the girl does 4 years later when her team loses in state. See, that doesn't make any sense there because... it doesn't make any sense because she's not got another 4 years of high school and she's not playing state in college, right? So
right.
Who's the girl?
I don't know. See, I didn't even realize I didn't understand the ending until now. And now yeah. I have no idea.
Right. So, wow. Let's see.
Huh.
Fascinating. So
and now this is going to stick with you even more because of that.
Right. Into the winking scope and dead eye of her new dad. And she looks to the Elkhead woman to the calf and sees now that both her fathers have stood at the top of this slope behind a rifle. And the elk have always been down here and it can stop. It has to stop. The old man telling this in the Star Lodge says to the children sitting all around him, now where was that happening? It has to stop. He says, so is she remembering something from the past? It has to stop, he says, brushing his stubby braids out of the way. And the girl, she knows this. She can feel it. She can see her real dad dead in that burned... Okay, so she is the girl. But she's remembering the past when there was an old man telling something in the Star Lodge to children sitting all around him, and she was one of the kids. Right?
Well, so maybe...
So now it has to stop... He said, brushing his stubby braids out of the wall, and the girl, now she's sitting with them. She can feel it. And then she can see her real dad dead in that burned down sweat lodge. the back of his head gone, but she can also see him up the slope 10 years ago, shooting into the herd of elk that weren't his to shoot at, and she hates that he's dead. She loved him. She is him in every way that counts. But her new dad shooting the elk beside her isn't going to bring him back. And as long as she keeps dribbling behind her back when she doesn't have to, then her real dad won't even be gone, will he? He'll be still there in the reckless smile, because nobody can kill that. So this is where the old man looks from face to face of the children in a lodge, a blanket of stars spread out around them. This is where he says, so this is like some mystical moment. This is where he says to all the children gathered around him, that around the fire, that what the girl does here for Ponoka, but also for her whole tribe, what she does is slide forward on her bloody knees, placing her small body between that rifle and the elk that killed her dad. She holds her right hand up the slope, palm out, finger spread, and the old man demonstrates, and she says it clear in that cold air, "No, Dad, no." Is it the first time she's called him that? It is, the old man says. It is. This is amazing. By slow degrees, the rifle raises, its butt settling down onto Denny Pease's right hip. So he does not fire. Now he's put it in a hold position. He's pointing it in the air. He's just a silhouette all the way up there, just another hunter. For a long moment, the elkhead woman doesn't move, so she's under the girl, is just hunched there around her calf, but then her long head wrenches around, ready to flinch from that next shot, to take her legs away, to start this whole cycle all over. Instead, the man shape up there, he's sliding his right hand sideways, palm down, left to right, the old man says. It's the Indian way of saying a thing is over. It's what he used to end every meeting with when he was trying to pull Gabe and Cass and Ricky and Lewis back, keep them alive. It's what he would have told his grandson if he could have. I think this is amazing, because what he's talking about is like breaking a cycle of violence, right?
Yeah.
And
I think so. I think
it's
right,
it's yeah. Like there's a tradition thing in there too. You know, there's like, you know, circles and circles, right? You know, so it's kids rebelling against tradition, but maintaining tradition. And then violence.
And the use of the tradition helps them communicate something in a really drastic situation, the hand right. movement.
Amazing.
So then what does it mean when it says that the Crow team figured out how to defeat her?
Right. So she loses the game later today is what I think that's saying, but she plays it. So the girl, 4 years later, when her team loses state in double overtime, he balls that hand in an upright fist. So what the girl will be doing with that held up fist at the end of that forever game, it's honoring the Crow team that finally figured out how to shut her down, the first defense ever to do that and one of the last. That show of sportsmanship, respect, of honor is what gets silhouetted on thousands of posters. So it's like she went and played.
Huh.
And that day is today. But she lost because she spent. But yet it took forever. That's what I'm reading. I don't know.
It seems like the fact that it's Crow is really important, but I don't.
Yeah, I'm like, and the fact that it's Crow, I mean, she mentioned that earlier, that was the team that they were going to play.
Because Shaney's Crow.
Right, right. Shaney, and so was Joe. Joe is also right. Crow.
So there's something there.
And that's why there was a challenge there between Joe. Why Denora felt compelled to play her in the first place was that she was Crow. And it was a pride thing.
And I have to say, when you read his short stories, this is the same thing that happens.
Wow.
Like you get to the end, you're like, wait.
Well, that's the first time I think I've read the end of a book live on a podcast. It is amazing. It's even more amazing than I thought it was when we started to talk. Because of this end is incredibly meaningful. And it's still growing. You know, it's in there. This just became a 5-star book.
Yeah.
For me. I had given it 4. But it's 5.
I definitely thought so. I just haven't been able to write about it, but now maybe I can.
Well, thanks for taking this journey with me, because that was fun.
Yeah, that's the best kind of book.
It is. Yeah, agreed.
And now I definitely want to go back and read more of his catalog, because all the books look to be so different. And, you know, I feel like he's doing some really unique stuff.
He is. And is that what you've read so far, is Mongrels and then the short story collection and this one?
Yeah.
Have you read? So you haven't read. There was one, I think it was called Mapping the Interior.
It's on my to read list. Okay. I went and looked at that when you said something about it.
Yeah, the other day, and I think it's a tour one, isn't it? One of those tour novellas.
Oh, maybe.
I think it's one of those.
He doesn't seem to stick with one publisher, I've noticed. Yeah.
Well, good for him. Yeah. Good for him. Maybe it allows him to publish more. I don't know. But yeah, he's definitely somebody that I can't wait to read more of. Does him being a Native American feed into everything you've read so far? Is it important to what you've read? Like in Mongrels, is that part of Mongrels? Or
I don't feel like it comes through in as a obvious way.
Okay.
I'd have to do a close reading to see if I thought it did otherwise.
Okay. I'm just curious if he was writing pretty much, you know, Native American stories, or if he was kind of all over the place.
But. No, and I think that's always kind of like a double-edged sword for anyone from a different background, right? It's like people ding them if they write it, and they ding them if they don't.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's horrible. I don't know. Yeah. Yeah.
So I think he actually is pretty well established just as a horror writer. Like, you wouldn't even know, seeing his name, that he was from this background.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I think this novel in particular, he just went all out.
Yeah. That's great.
It's like, you want tropes? I'm going to use the tropes.
Yeah, one of the interesting things I got out of an interview that I heard, that one, is that he tends to write in a short amount of time. Once he starts to write, he tends to get her done. It's like 4 to 6 weeks for a novel, he said. Wow. And he said part of that is because he gets so much into it, and it's very affecting. You know, it's probably not healthy for him to spend more time than that in there. So it's an intense work, you know, from the way he was describing it. He's really, that's what his life becomes until he can be done.
Wow.
So, yeah.
I guess I can kind of see that in this book.
Mm-hmm.
And how you also would want to be over with writing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
More quickly.
Yeah, no question.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's very good.
Fantastic. It is very good. And again, a nice October read. Thank you so much for being here. And thank you for this book and yet another direction for me to head down.
Thanks for having me.
Another rabbit hole to stick my head in. Yeah. This could easily become another favorite author.
Yeah, for me too.
Yeah, for sure.